Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench. Everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake. It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 central on CBS.
Hackers are after your business data. I can help. I am Vi, the virtual intelligence assistant at Virtual Armor.
Virtual Armor, partnered with Juniper Networks, provides cybersecurity services and end-to-end solutions to keep what's yours, yours. Defend yourself with managed firewall and managed SIM essential core services that are economical and efficient. Virtual Armor goes beyond just initial alerting to provide a thorough report on threats, vulnerabilities, and results.
Let me help protect you. Contact me at justaskvi. That's vi.com.
Well, good morning, Carolinas. Welcome to Carolina Focus on News Talk 1110 99.3 WBT, 107.9 The Link, and 102.5 610 Sports Radio FNZ. It's also available as a podcast on WBT.com. We're your co-hosts, Sharon Thorsland, Ahmed Billick. This Sunday, let's get started with Dr. Drew Watson, University of Wisconsin professor. He talks about youth sports and COVID and what we know so far. Sit back and relax, and good morning, and welcome to Carolina Focus.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Carolina Focus. I'm Sharon Thorsland. Well, sports are in full swing, at least for professional athletes. College is also on board, at least some of them. But what about youth sports? I know that some of them have started back up again. My children are playing soccer right now, also baseball. But I know that there's a lot of fear and apprehension among a lot of parents and athletes probably who are worried about playing sports during the coronavirus pandemic. And there's been a recent study, though, that might help put your minds at rest. And here to tell us about that study is Dr. Drew Watson. He is a physician at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He is also the chief medical advisor of the Elite Clubs National League, which promotes youth soccer development. Dr. Watson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sharon. It's great to be with you.
Now, you co-authored a pair of studies relating to youth sports and COVID-19. One of them, I understand, looked at the impact of school and sport cancellations among youth athletes. And the other focused on the spread of COVID-19 among soccer athletes. So can you first start out with telling us about the first study with how what the impact has been on kids that had to have sports canceled, because most of them were canceled, obviously, in the spring and a lot of them in the summer. What did you find in that study?
Sure. So like a lot of places throughout the country, this came on us very suddenly. And in the spring, we all of a sudden had school and sport cancellation. And to give credit where it's due, one of my collaborators here at UW, Tim McGuine, had the foresight to quickly reach out kind of nationwide and develop a survey to look at the mental health and physical activity of young athletes in the aftermath of all of these school and sport cancellations. And so that data captured about responses from about 13,000 kids across the country. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of normative data in young athletes in terms of mental health specifically. But because we had been collecting this data in Wisconsin, we could look at the changes from pre-COVID to during the school and sport cancellations within the athletes in our state. So we were able to compare historical data from about 5,000 Wisconsin high school athletes to a little over 3,000 of them in May of this year. And what we found was that, not too surprisingly, physical activity had dropped by about half. I think this was the reality we all experienced as parents and coaches, which is there were reduced opportunities for physical activity that were hard to replace within the restrictions that we had. But I think what was really unnerving for us was that if you look at the proportion of our Wisconsin athletes historically that report the degree of depression that you might think would warrant further evaluation or intervention by a healthcare provider, it's historically been less than 10%. But in May of this year, it had more than tripled to about a third, or 33% of our athletes were reporting this. About one in four were reporting moderate to severe anxiety. And so this really, I think, made us recognize the significant impact that this was having on young athletes. Now, of course, COVID-19 is a terrible disease. It continues to spread. It's responsible for a tremendous amount of death and suffering. What we wanted to identify was whether or not we could see if sports were restarted, did that seem to increase the risk of contracting COVID-19 among athletes? So we felt pretty comfortable that restricting them from school and sports had pretty negative effects on things like physical and mental health, but would reintroducing it increase the risk of COVID-19 to the extent where we shouldn't be doing it? So in the summer, a lot of groups were restarting in certain sports. And so with the help of the ECNL, we distributed a survey to their membership to gauge the numbers of COVID cases and the number of participating athletes among their member clubs. And what we found was that during that summer period, the case rate and the incidence rate that we got back were certainly not higher than the national incidence rates that we see from the data from the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example. So at least within that data set, it didn't seem to suggest that participating in soccer is associated with an increased risk of COVID-19. Now, it's sort of hard to contextualize that to other sports or indoor activities. And so we sought to replicate that here in Wisconsin within our high school athletes recently. And just recently distributed information back about this that very similarly showed that our high school athletes in Wisconsin within the sports that had restarted did not seem to have an increased incidence of COVID-19 when compared to the background incidence of just being an adolescent in Wisconsin. So together, these, at least among athletes, don't seem to suggest that participating in outdoor sports at this time of year is associated with an increased risk of COVID-19 compared to just being a kid in the U.S. or in Wisconsin.
Well, when you look at this first study that you started with the soccer youth, how many people were involved in that study and what age range was it?
So we distributed it to the club directors within each organization, and they completed it on behalf of their whole organization. So we ended up with 124 clubs that had restarted participation. They represent over 90,000 kids. Wow. So some of those clubs have, 100, some have 2,000. So there's a lot of variability. Some clubs had restarted just at kind of adolescent ages. Some have kids that are participating as young as even 5 or 6 years old. So it varies from one to the next. We felt like because we were getting answers from clubs that are in 34 total states, that this was pretty representative of youth soccer across the country. And so we simply compared it to the background COVID incidents and case rates for kids across the United States. And really found that being a soccer player, at least at that time of the year, didn't seem to increase your risk of contracting COVID-19.
I know that you are a parent. I'm a parent. That makes me feel a whole lot better considering my daughter is currently playing soccer. Why do you think that it is that they aren't having an increase in the COVID-19 cases among kids who are playing sports? Because you'd think, especially in something like soccer, I mean, you're right on top of each other. What do you think has been the difference?
I mean, I certainly think there are things about soccer that probably make it less risky than other activities. It's outdoors. Generally speaking, kids are pretty widely distributed across a relatively large area. That will differ from young ages to older, right? I mean, we've all watched soccer games where six-year-olds are sort of crowded around the ball, and that may be a different context than older players. When there is some preliminary data from others that have looked at how much time people actually spend within 6 feet of another individual during a soccer game, and it's relatively small. There are brief periods where you have contact with other players, but most of the time you're spread out from them. And I think that probably reduces the risk associated with that activity. But I also think that one of the most important things that we found both in that soccer study as well as within high school athletes is that these organizations are utilizing a lot of risk reduction practices.
That's what
they're doing, things like symptom monitoring, temperature checks, hygiene, disinfection, their, you know, social distancing off the field. They may be having mask use sort of to and from the field. Some are even doing it on the field. And I think that what we're seeing is that these organizations are highly motivated to try to make it as safe as they can. Now, the data that we have can't speak to whether, you know, any of those specific interventions are truly affecting the risk or not, but it's at least encouraging to see that these organizations are taking a lot of steps to try and protect the athletes when they're participating. And intuitively to me, it seems like that would potentially reduce the risk as well.
When you talk about moving into additional sports, what ones are you looking at with your Wisconsin high school athletes right now?
Yeah, so this was specifically distributed to all of the high schools at the end of September regarding COVID cases and sports that were going on during the month of September. So every school is a little bit different, but the ones that are traditionally the fall sports that they're participating in are cross country, football, swimming, volleyball, tennis, boys soccer in Wisconsin, girls golf. So it sort of varies depending on which school you are at, but those were the fall sports that we had the most responses about. And so those were the ones that we were able to kind of compare to the background incidence rate here in our state.
So with what you've seen so far, I know that particularly people are worried about football here in the Charlotte area. They've postponed high school football for public schools until next spring. They are just now starting to allow some things like cross country coming back in and volleyball. What kinds of numbers have you seen specifically with those sports? And do you feel like that it is safe for kids to start participating in those?
Yeah, I think that really is a great question. We haven't directly compared sports to one another. In some sports, you really just don't have that much data. I mean, it may only be a handful of schools. It may be a relatively small sample of athletes. So sometimes we feel a little hesitant to try and make those comparisons because you could end up finding things that aren't true, but are sort of spurious in terms of a statistical result. We compared the incidence rates of each sport individually against kind of the Wisconsin background rate. And we didn't find that there was any, at least statistical, difference between the incidence rates within any specific sport and the Wisconsin background rate. So in other words, there doesn't seem to be an increased risk of COVID-19 in being a football player compared to being an adolescent in Wisconsin. Same thing could be said for, you know, being a boys soccer athlete or a cross country athlete. I think as we accumulate more data, we'll better be able to try and identify whether certain characteristics of sports are associated with more or less risk. So outdoor versus indoor, contact versus non-contact. And we may actually be able to tease out the specific effects of different risk protection practices like utilizing a mask while playing, which is a big ongoing discussion. We're going to be replicating both of these studies nationally, club within a handful of different sports, high schools nationally across the country through the various state associations in the next few weeks. So my hope is that as we continue to replicate this and get more and more information, we may be able to speak more directly to some of these more nuanced questions.
We're speaking with Dr. Drew Watson. He's a physician at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the chief medical advisor of the Elite Clubs National League, which is an organization that promotes youth soccer development. Dr. Watson has been the co-author of a couple of studies here relating to youth sports and COVID-19 and discussing those with us this morning here on Carolina Focus. Now, I know that football is a big one that everybody is, particularly here in the South, that people are really interested in. You see the NFL, and they've had pockets of COVID-19 pop up, but it almost doesn't seem like it's spreading on the field. It's more like these guys are contracting it off the field and then bringing it in. Do you feel that with the high school players and what you've seen so far with the youth soccer, that it's not really the transmission on the field so much as that people are just getting it out in real life?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's very hard to address that specifically within the data that we have. I do think that athletes, because they live in the community, are going to be similarly representative of the transmission rates that are going on in the community. I think what we were trying to do is identify whether just being an athlete puts you at an increased risk relative to the risk that's going on in the background. And at least as far as we've been able to look at it so far, it doesn't seem that being an athlete incorporates an increased risk. Now, we've got, you know, relatively narrow populations that we've looked at so far. I mean, we've looked at youth soccer, which is relevant for, you know, youth soccer athletes, and we've looked at Wisconsin high school athletics. But I think there's a real need to try and expand these into broader populations so that we can speak a little more generally about the potential risk. But so far, it doesn't appear that simply being an athlete puts you at an increased risk of contracting COVID-19 just compared to being a citizen within the community that you live in. Now, unfortunately, community rates are still on the rise in a number of places, and I think as a part of broader public health efforts, this may warrant discontinuing all sorts of things, and youth sports may be kind of grouped into those restrictions. But at least within the data that we have so far, it doesn't appear to us that being an athlete incorporates an increased risk.
And based on the other study that you did, being able to allow these kids to participate in sports is certainly beneficial for them mentally and physically.
I think that is the decision that we're trying to navigate as sports medicine providers, as parents, as coaches, is trying to negotiate this balance between the known wide-ranging benefits of sport participation for physical health, for mental health, for social well-being, to balance that against the potential transmission of COVID-19, which obviously has permeated all of our lives in an incredible number of ways. I think those decisions are going to be made by individual public health agencies, families, and even sports organization based on the context within their local area. For me currently, for my kids, on balance, I think that the benefit they get out of sport participation where we live right now outweighs my perception of their risk. And so I continue to take them. But I can imagine making a different decision if the context changes. I think that's just the hardest part about negotiating all of this information. We're just trying to insert some amount of data to inform that sort of decision making to hopefully help people do that on their own.
So you said that you've already started looking at the high school sports, certain sports. Will you continue to look at sports as they unfold, like if basketball gets started? Because I'm sure that that's a big one that people are concerned about because it is inside.
Absolutely. I think what we've been able to do so far is look at predominantly outdoor sports as they, you know, exist within what's going on in the fall and the summer. We're intending to expand this data collection through high schools nationally at the end of this month, like I mentioned, through various club sports through kind of November. And then my expectation is this will be sort of iterative, where we'll do it again in the winter, potentially again towards the beginning of the spring, and hopefully we can make more kind of direct comments on the risk associated with different types of activities, especially as we start going indoors. My expectation is that, you know, there may be differential risk between different types of sports for a number of reasons, but we're hoping we can speak a little bit more directly about that rather than just sort of assuming it's the case.
Now, I know that you have also, as part of your work, have published return to play recommendations for teams and different sports. Can you tell us a little bit about what those are and what they entail and how they're helping advise youth leagues really all around the country in return to sports?
Yeah, sure. So kind of early on this spring, you know, everything kind of closed down and a lot of restrictions were in place broadly to where most of youth sports had discontinued. But not too long after that, groups started looking at reinitiating, and there wasn't a lot of formal guidance about how to do so. There was some early information from the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. There was some broad information from the World Health Organization and the CDC, but there wasn't a lot of sport-specific information about how to reinitiate in certain contexts. So within the ECNL, we wanted to try and at least provide some guidance for our organizations about how they could potentially reintroduce participation in a way that we thought would reduce the risk of COVID-19 spread among soccer players. So we developed initially return-to-play recommendations for training with the deliberate intent to try and promote at least a handful of weeks of training before returning to competition, not only to try and reduce the risk of COVID-19 spread, but to also potentially reduce the risk of injuries if we rush back to competition too quickly. And then not long after that, we distributed return to play recommendations for competition. And these really entail kind of our attempts to give soccer specific guidance about ways to incorporate risk reduction strategies within the training and the competition environment. So some of that is fairly universal in terms of things like hand washing, symptom monitoring, temperature checks, and so on. Some of it is about reducing contact surfaces within soccer. So making sure that multiple players aren't coming into contact with a ball with their hands, they could potentially transmit the virus that way. Ensuring that we incorporate ways to stagger arrival and departure times so that there's not a lot of congestion in parking lots that could form a basis for transmission. And really trying to drive home that while we may not think that soccer in and of itself incorporates a significant risk of transmission during play, really trying to drive home the importance of doing things like social distancing, you know, hand washing and all of these things off the field so that that doesn't become a transmitted, even if we think that the soccer participation itself is relatively safe.
What's been the response from youth sports leagues, or have you heard from people about this study and coaches, and what's been their response to this and to your return to play recommendations?
I mean, I think the return to play recommendations were received quite well. I mean, we did ultimately incorporate questions within the survey that we distributed to the ECNL, asking them kind of where did they get information about developing their protocols, what kind of risk reduction procedures were they using, and thankfully, I think for us, they did endorse utilizing ours. A large proportion of them reported utilizing the return to play recommendations we made, and the practices that they endorsed using, I think, were largely a reflection of what we had recommended. They're obviously always going to be influenced by what they're being encouraged or required to do locally as well, but it did seem like there was good uptake of the recommendations we made, and that this, at least by their report, was reflected in the protocols that they were utilizing. I think as far as the data about COVID-19 incidents, this is obviously a very contentious issue. And like a lot of things that get discussed around COVID-19 can at times be politicized or utilized to further someone's agenda. I have no real interest in any of those things. I'm simply trying to provide information to inform discussions. And I think that the discussions that are being had around this that do try and incorporate evidence in light of whatever limitations they may have when they're developed really is the only way forward, I think, that can meaningfully reduce the risk across communities while still potentially promoting the health benefits of participation in sports.
We've seen the professional sports leagues be able to come back successfully, although the NBA was obviously in a complete bubble situation, which is unrealistic for the rest of the world. But have you learned anything, or can we take anything away from how the pro leagues are doing it to start maybe incorporating that into the high school and youth sports, or is that even realistic?
I mean, I think certain elements are going to be very hard to translate into the day-to-day reality that youth sports live in. There may be attempts to recreate some of that within college settings. I think the take home is that when you truly are able to reduce the time in close proximity to other people, when you really are able to promote mask use when you're not able to stay distant from people, when you really are diligent about symptom monitoring, about temperature checks, about hand washing, they really do seem to have a significant impact. That's not exclusive to sports, but I do think it just has to be a continual message from people that are trying to facilitate youth sport participation, that if we're going to be able to do it in a safe way, we just really have to be able to prioritize those things and not try to cut corners or perceive them as being unnecessary. They really probably are the key to being able to do this safely. And to the extent that our data support this, I mean, we've reported COVID-19 incidence rates within a couple different populations, and they don't appear to be greater than the background incidence. But these groups are also reporting very, very high utilization rates of different risk protection protocols. So I can't definitively prove that those are responsible. I certainly can't say that you would have the same kind of relatively low incidence rates if you didn't use those things. I think if anything, we need to be highlighting that these are being utilized, and in those situations, the COVID-19 risk doesn't appear to be greater than just the risk of being a kid if you're an athlete.
So where do we go from here now for parents that are sitting here listening to this today saying, wow, my child really wants to play basketball this winter, or they want to participate in cross country? Do you feel like, I know that you don't have exact details on all of these different sports, but do you feel that overall that it is safe for youth to participate as long as there are safety precautions being put into place?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I will say it's very hard to speak generally for all contexts. I think if you're a family making a decision about your children's participation, there are a number of things that we need to be able to consider. I mean, high levels of community transmission mean that just the risk of contracting it in any context is probably going to be higher than it would otherwise. I think that if you ultimately decide that the value that your children and the health benefits that your children get out of participation in sports outweigh the potential risk of contracting COVID-19 within that activity, then I think it's a reasonable thing to decide to do so, provided you're really diligent about utilizing these risk reduction procedures. I mean, you really are checking your temperature every day before you go. You really are staying home if you have any symptoms. Even if you think, you know, this feels like allergies, if you have, you know, congestion, don't go. I mean, if you have any symptoms that could be aligned with COVID-19, stay home until you can prove otherwise. And for organizations, we really should be looking for them to endorse the sort of practices that appear to be potentially keeping young athletes safe. But whether you know, you can make the same decision in different sports, I think really remains to be seen. If on balance, as a family, ultimately decide that participation in an indoor sport seems to be, you know, relatively safe compared to the value that you get out of it, and you're able to do so within the provision of all of these risk reduction procedures, and it's allowed within the local guidelines in your community, then I think you make that decision for your family. I mean, we negotiate this every day. We're in the upper Midwest, where there are a lot of cases and community transmission is really rising. So we revisit that in my house all the time, and it's a moving target. I don't make the same decision one week to the next just by default. It really is about reassessing the available information. My hope is that as we continue to collect and analyze and disseminate what we find, that will help inform those conversations for people.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing the results of the additional sports that you guys are looking at. It'll be really interesting and informative, I think, for everybody involved to get the results of that and see where we go from here in this coronavirus pandemic that is certainly not going away. Well, Dr. Watson, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about your studies. We really appreciate talking with you today.
Thank you, Sharon.
We've been speaking with Dr. Drew Watson. He's a physician at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and also the chief medical advisor of the Elite Clubs National League, a soccer, youth soccer development program. And he was telling us about both of his studies relating to youth sports and COVID-19, and we look forward to hearing the results of his next study in the future. Thank you so much for joining us today on Carolina Focus.
And thank you, Sharon. Hey, coming up after the break, a Davidson grad through drone technologies creates unique ways of using these technologies to not only clean buildings, but to keep us healthy and safe. Coming up right after the break here on Carolina Focus. Well, welcome back to Carolina Focus here on this wonderful fall Sunday. Carolina Focus is heard on News Talk 1110, 99.3 WBT, 107.9 The Link, and 102.5 610 Sports Radio WFNZ. We are all part of Intercom Charlotte. I'm your co-host, Ed Billick, along with Sharon Thorsland. The second half of the show, let's get started with a discussion Sharon had with Andrew Asher. He's a Davidson grad and co-founder and CEO of Lucid Drone Technologies. I love this story. A young man, along with his buddy, figure out a way to use new technologies in helping us keep clean and keep safe. Take it away, Sharon.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Carolina Focus. Well, as we all unfortunately know, this coronavirus pandemic does not seem to be going away anytime soon. And I know lots of people are worried about picking up the virus, particularly in public spaces. And you might have heard recently about the Panthers and their germ-fighting robots. Well, today we're going to hear about a germ-fighting drone. It was invented right here in Charlotte. And joining me right now is Andrew Asher. He's the co-founder and CEO of Lucid Drone Technologies. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know in reading a little bit about your background, you were a baseball player and attended Davidson and graduated a little bit early, I believe, from Davidson. Tell us a little bit about your background. And
sure. So I guess I took a fairly circuitous route when it comes to technology startups. And I can attribute a lot of it to my family life and early childhood. I was born and raised into a family of teachers. So learning was always just a love and a passion and something that was really kind of emphasized early on. And because of that, I'm a self-acclaimed nerd through and through and just always love to learn new things, read and digest new information. And round about the fall of our junior year, two friends and I got together with this problem in mind of people were hanging off the sides of buildings trying to clean. And the thought that was bothering us was, how has no one found a way to leverage existing technology to make that a safer job? And we just launched ourselves headfirst into coming up with a solution by leveraging drone technology to clean buildings. So that's how we originally got our start, was building and programming drones that were capable of cleaning the exterior buildings, anything from washing windows to roofs, all the way to brick. You name the surface and structure, we found a way to clean it with a drone. And I guess to jump ahead a little bit, now in the midst of the pandemic, we pivoted ever so slightly. We're still kind of at this intersection of industrial drones and cleaning, but now we're applying disinfectant solution to different venues like professional sports stadiums.
Wow. Wow. That seems like a pretty wild road to go down. Now, when you were at Davidson, is this something that you started when you were at Davidson, or were what program were you involved in at Davidson?
Sure.
This has been a presentation of Radio.com Sports, presented by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Learn more at Indeed.com/credit.
Really a need. Would people appreciate this product if we built it? And then the spring of our junior year, we were finalists for the Davidson College Venture Fund. We got teamed up with a group of local mentors that we'd meet with once a week to start to help us prepare for this pitch competition, and as a result, really teach us a lot about business and start to take this out of, say, the idea phase and move it more into, okay, now we understand how this could be a business phase. And we were fortunate that they were all phenomenal and we learned a lot, and several of them are actually still advisors for us to this day. We went on to win that venture fund competition and got some early interest from investors, but the recurring theme was, hey guys, this is a really great idea, an attractive market, but it's not attractive as a side project. And I was fortunate that looking at my transcript, I was able to graduate a year early. So I graduated a year early to really focus on the company and build it. And I'm incredibly grateful I made that decision.
So it sounds like it was sort of like a Shark Tank-like competition that got you going down this road.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. It was the first time I had ever like pitched the company in front of a large crowd, and was nerve-wracking in some ways, but something I really enjoyed. And my mom now likes to joke, as a kid growing up, I always wanted to be a professional pitcher, of course, on the baseball side. And now I have, in fact, grown up to be a professional pitcher, but instead what I do is pitch the company to customers, partners, investors, whatever it happens to be.
I love it. I love that analogy. That's great. So I know that you had some of your background comes from that. Is it called the Hurt Hub there at Davidson? Is that what you were working within to sort of get things going?
Yes. So early on, we worked a lot out of the Hurt Hub at Davidson. And honestly, it was, I believe, the summer right after junior year is when it officially opened. So very early on, we didn't have access to all of those resources. But then for that next year, while my two co-founders were still finishing their senior year, We worked out of the hub constantly, had a lot of our meetings there, met with customers there, and also just had access to a healthy host of entrepreneurs that had experienced many of the same problems we were experiencing and could shed light on what needed to be done early on to try to build a successful company. So we definitely learned and grew a lot during that incubation phase.
How important was that for you guys to have that as a building block to sort of get you going?
If you were to remove Davidson College and I'd say the Davidson ecosystem from our equation, I'm not sure we'd be where we are today. When it comes to, say, the cleaning drone specifically, all of our early tests were done on Davidson College's facilities, and their facility staff was welcoming with open arms to say, hey, try it out here, try it out there. Provide us with a lot of insight in terms of how much does it cost to clean different buildings. Here's feedback on after you clean a building, is this actually as good as it would be by hand? And really accelerated our learning by having access to facilities like that. And then I can't say enough about the alumni network. So much of our learning and early connections have been just specifically through Davidson College alumni. So despite being a somewhat small school, we're a powerful school when it comes to the networking effect.
Wow. Well, so you decided that you were going to go into the drone business. How do you even start with something like that? I mean, you just go buy a drone? Do you build your own drone, or what's sort of the protocol?
So I guess the first thing I'll say is you start with an open mind. And where we originally started was trying to take the path of least resistance. So we didn't set out to necessarily build our own drones. We went and got pinched our pennies and took everything out of our savings account to go buy this industrial drone from a third-party builder that we could then, manipulate for our own needs and purposes. And that was good enough to prove that conceptually drone cleaning could work. It had a long way to go because there are a lot of limitations to that platform. So at that point, we're like, okay, we know this is a great market. This is going to save people a lot of time and money, and we really need to go out and build this. And we just set out to build our own drones where we could customize every single aspect of the hardware and software for these purpose-built applications where we could, instead of building a drone that could go shoot a real estate house or do a bridge inspection, we wanted to build a drone that could spray solution on a building, spray solution on stadium seats, and do these, I guess, more unique applications. Okay. And that's really what we specialize in now. We're located in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm happy to say we have a growing team, and it feels a bit surreal to have this team of more than 10 people where we're doing all of the hardware in-house, we're doing all of the development in-house, and it's been really fun to build multiple drones a week and get them out the door to customers because it's been a healthy evolution from our early days.
Wow. So you build your own drones now. How long does it take to build a drone, and how many people are involved in working on each drone?
So it will depend. We really break the drone down into sub-assemblies so different people can kind of specialize in different aspects. Again, the timing varies. Right now, we're pushing out several drones a week and know what levers to pull as we start to scale that. I'd like to think that manufacturing is something that you put some more man hours towards it, it scales fairly linearly. And there was another question in there that I'm neglecting.
Oh, I was sorry. How long does it take to push the one out or to finish a drone? How many hours
Sure.
does it take to build one?
So if it were to be just one person and we were kind of going from A to Z, building the drone, wiring the drone, programming, and then doing what we do, which is like a test and validation burn-in process, you're looking at roughly a day's time for a single person.
Okay. And you said you have about 10 people working within the company right now. Are they mostly fellow Davidson alum? I know that you and your co-founders all went there. Does everybody else as well?
Truthfully, from all over the place. But we did recently hire another Davidson alumnus, which is our first Davidson hire. So that was a very rewarding one. But we're from all over the place. Alabama, Rutgers, NC State, Purdue, Penn State. So a healthy mix.
Okay. So now you've got this drone business up and running. You started focusing on cleaning the exterior of buildings. Now, coronavirus pandemic hit back in the spring. And as you said earlier in the interview, you pivoted to say, okay, how can we work within this whole new world that we're in and see how we can adapt these drones? So what was the first thing that you guys thought of back when this hit that you could try to adjust your use of your drones?
So really the first place we looked was what relationships had we already built and what could we learn from those people about what was happening in the world and just try to be a sponge and soak up as much information as possible. So we were speaking to a lot of the cleaning companies we've been working with, chemical partners, and honestly, one of the organizations that was really foundational in us transitioning to the disinfecting drone was the North Carolina Military Business Center. We've been developing a relationship with them for almost a year now on various applications in which our technology could provide value for the military. And when the virus broke out, there were a lot of conversations about how the drones could be used for different military applications. And they were really thoughtful and helpful as we went about that process of trying to do the early development and test and validation with the disinfecting drone. So I definitely want to give a thank you to them.
Okay, we're speaking with Andrew Asher. He is the co-founder and CEO of Lucid Drone Technologies, and we're discussing their germ-fighting drones that they're now using to help combat the coronavirus pandemic. So you started out speaking with the military about doing that. How did you get into, I see now that you've been disinfecting the Atlanta Falcons football stadium.
Mm-hmm. So it's been a... Gosh, I guess a roller coaster ride in terms of where we've been and who we've done work with. Early on, we were providing services locally, just proving out the concept, really making sure that we had a quality product. So we would do sections by hand, do sections with the drone, take measurements and readings, and make sure that what we were developing is truly impactful. And once we got past that, we more or less went on a roadshow of tours. We went up and down the Southeast to different universities and professional sports stadiums, just showing, hey, here's our technology, here's how it works. We know fans aren't back today, but when they do come back and you have to regularly disinfect your seats, please keep us in mind. And one thing led to another, where now we've launched several universities like Texas A&M, and we're working with Baylor now. And it was really rewarding last week to launch our first professional sporting client down in Atlanta.
Okay. So how does it work when you just, who flies the drone? Do you guys go and do the disinfecting and fly the drone around? Or how does the actual technology work? What do you actually do to work this thing?
So, well, we actually are the technology providers in the relationship. So, for example, let's just talk about Atlanta for a second. We lease them our technology, and on the front end, we'll go and provide training to their staff and equip them with the knowledge necessary on how to operate the drone. So if they have an MLS game Saturday night and then a NFL game on Sunday afternoon, their internal staff has the ability and flexibility to do that disinfecting work on their own.
Okay.
So we're really more of us as an enabler. We want to provide our productivity improving solution and then continue to provide support and maintenance throughout the course of that relationship.
Okay. So you go and basically train the people. Do they need to have, I thought I was reading it on your website, that you actually have to have some sort of a pilot license kind of thing to actually be a licensed operator of a drone? Do you have to train them to do that?
So it depends. Specifically for Atlanta, because it's an indoor stadium, there are a different set of regulations that apply, and they don't fall underneath the FAA's jurisdiction since it's an enclosed environment and not a part of the national airspace system.
Okay. But if it was an outside facility, is that something that people have to do?
Yes, there's a different set of regulations, and that's part of what our company does, is help walk every company through that process.
Okay. So you give them these drones, or they purchase them or lease them, and then do they just like hook it up to a hose, or how does it work when they want to go in and say clean Saturday after a game?
So for the disinfecting drone, it actually has an onboard tank, making it really flexible when you're, say, climbing over rows of seats in a stadium. And just in terms of simple schematics, you've got that onboard tank and then a pump that filters out to two different electrostatic nozzles that then spray the solution downwards onto the surface. And then you've got a pilot that operates the drone.
Okay. Okay. How long does it take approximately, as opposed to like a cleaning crew coming in to clean the football stadium? How much time does it save to have a drone do it?
Sure. So it varies depending upon, say, venue. I know specifically for Atlanta's, on their calculations, it was going to take roughly 75 hours to do by hand. And with the drones, they're hoping to do it in 4.
Wow. That's a huge difference. Wow. So obviously you've got the Falcons on board now in some colleges and universities. What's the reaction you've been getting from people when you're pitching this to them? Is this something that they are truly interested in?
You know, it's one of those things that conceptually you talk to people about it and they're like, yes, this just makes sense. But it's also a seeing is believing. So we've really found like people are excited about it, but there's always a certain degree of skepticism until they see it in action. And then once they can actually like put their finger on it, they're like, okay, yeah, this makes a ton of sense. So what we do on our end is just try to provide as much of that information as we can on the front end to get past that, oh, does this actually work? Because it seems like it should be in the future.
Okay. So you were saying earlier that you've done a lot of tests to show that it is just as effective. I mean, is this something that you can pretty much guarantee that when this drone goes in there to disinfect, it's clean and disinfected? No questions?
Yeah, if you're hitting the intended surface with a disinfectant solution, you're doing your best job to mitigate whatever pathogens are on that surface. So depend upon what solution you use. We're chemical agnostic, but different chemicals will have different claims in terms of, say, like pathogen reduction, whether it's a 99.99% reduction or it goes several more decimal points.
Okay. So it sounds like this is maybe the wave of the future, particularly because we're in this pandemic still and it doesn't look to be going away anytime soon. I mean, do you foresee this just really taking off here in the next year or so?
I really do. It's especially for these unique venues like stadiums, they have a really tight operational window to turn around their facilities. And this is such an efficient way to do it versus handheld methods. It saves them a lot of time, but also makes it doable to disinfect with the regularity that's needed. And what I'll be interested to see is how do we change as a country in terms of regulations? So right now people are doing disinfecting more so from an organizational level just to provide, say, fans or occupants with peace of mind. But is this a global crisis where coming out of it, we see regulations put in place to hopefully mitigate the chances of a large outbreak occurring again?
Okay. Wow. It seems like y'all are sort of in the right place at the right time. Now, are you continuing to promote the drones and make the drones for the exterior building cleaning and stuff like that that you originally started the company for?
To a degree. So we're not currently launching cleaning drones, but we've been amassing an ever-growing waiting list of customers that are eager for the cleaning drone to return. But really where we started as a founding team was from a place of humanitarian concern and just wanting to create a safer way to clean buildings. And now in the midst of this pandemic, we really see how our drone technology can do a tremendous amount of good. And we're really focused on that cause. But at the same time, I think we're also itching to begin launching cleaning customers again and roll out that product.
Okay. Wow. What a neat idea. I saw on your website that I believe you're 24 years old. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Wow. Did you ever think that you would be the CEO and co-founder of a company like this when a lot of kids are just graduating from college and you're already well into a career like this?
Truthfully, I could never have imagined this is where I would have been when I rewind a couple of years into the past. I remember asking a mentor of mine back the fall of my junior year, and this is before we even started working on the company, just asking him for general career advice, thinking maybe I was going to do an internship in consulting or investment banking. And I remember he was telling me, he started one of the most now powerful consulting firms in the world. He was like, look, if you want to go into consulting, you can, but usually that's a placeholder until you figure out what you really want to do. So I want to push you. What is it that you really want to do? And I knew I always had this entrepreneurial spirit, and the thought of starting a company was exciting. So I also credit him to being that catalyst for getting the ball rolling on this.
Wow. What a neat company you've got going with such a really innovative idea. And like you said, it's just a humanitarian effect in there too, because of the good it's doing to try to help keep people safe during this coronavirus pandemic. We've been speaking with Andrew Asher. He's the co-founder and CEO of Lucid Drone Technologies. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today. Good luck in the future.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Fantastic story. Just love it. Hey, as we wrap up Carolina Focus, you know, last Monday, Bo Thompson spoke with Rhonda Cheek, CMS school board member, about kids going back to school. What? It's November. Kids going back to school? Hey, folks, it's 2020. Matter of fact, next weekend is the Masters tournament. Anyhow, let's listen in to Bo's discussion with Rhonda Cheek and this past Monday here on Carolina Focus.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block of your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'.
And so here we are on Monday, November 2nd. And I have monitors all throughout the studio, and I keep seeing back to school on so many of these monitors. Wait a minute, it is November, right? But yes, it's also 2020. And I want to welcome to the WBT hotline someone who has graciously offered her time throughout so much of this year, unprecedented year that has been 2020. Rhonda Cheek, CMS school board member. And it is back to school for a lot of students today. I have to tell you, Rhonda, I have two high schoolers in CMS in my house, and I know they are sitting back really rooting for the K-5ers today and everybody involved. Hopefully this goes well over the next few weeks, and then we continue with the plan. But we will have students back in classes today, the most we've had so far. So this is a good step.
This is a big step. Today is it's a great sunny day, and it's a beautiful Carolina blue sky, and I hope that we have kids and teachers that are following protocols and will keep us safe and keep us in school.
So nearly 40,000 students are going back on the A and B rotating schedule for the in-person learning this week. That means you still have about 23,500 that are in the K-5 full remote academy. And this is a hybrid, and so not everybody going back at the same time, K through 5, but just a snapshot of how this week works out if you do have K-5 students. Can you refresh us there a little bit?
Well, you've either been assigned to an A or a B. The A students are Monday, Tuesday. The Bs are Thursday, Friday. And Wednesdays are kind of catch-up, remote work with students, you know, extra things, and deep cleaning the buildings in between the groups of students. So this week's going to be new and different, and pray about it. And I hope that people will be patient. I'm not so sure that exists in our society at this moment. So I'm hoping for the best.
You know, I was listening to the school board meeting last week, and that was on the heels of one of the most recent news conferences from the governor, which the numbers did not sound good. And I started wondering, boy, I wonder if CMS is going to be able to implement this the way they intended. And then I listened to the school board meeting last week, and you know, I heard a lot of the voices, including yours, saying that the schools right now are prepared and ready, and the schools for many of these students may be the safest place for them to be as far as being protected from the virus right now.
Absolutely believe that, and I see that in workplaces that are following strict protocols. Students and teachers and staff that are wearing masks, doing social distancing and doing the things that need to be done, washing hands. We've got all the extra hand sanitizing stations in our schools. People are going to be following protocols in those environments that they're not doing potentially outside of those environments. And I see it every day in my own workplace. I feel safest when I'm at work. I don't feel as safe when I'm out in other venues. And so I do think that we are in a place where people will adapt to this and do well. And if you did hear the meeting, Health Department Director Gibby Harris said that she thinks it is a safe time, even given the numbers last week that she heard, for us to return our K-5 kids to school. They're safer in school, academically going to be more successful, and a lot of the issues we have with, nutrition and some of those other big concerns, people are going to be laying eyeballs on some of these kids that haven't had somebody doing that in a long time.
Look, I appreciate you coming on. This is a big day, and like I said, I think a lot of the kids who aren't going back this week, grade 6 through 8, November 23rd, 9th through 12th, have a December 14th EOC testing date, and then eventually in person on a regular basis January 5th. So provided this all goes well, that schedule I just laid out, that's all still in place as we know it?
Yes. Absolutely.
Tate, thanks for coming on, and we'll stay in touch. And like you said, be hoping everybody has a good first day of school today here in November. That sounds strange to say, but that's where we are.
News Talk 1110, 99.3 WPT, where Charlotte turns for traffic. Monday, it's a new episode of All Rise, the legal drama where one judge is shaking up the system.
When I take the bench, I'm taking a vow to fight for justice.
One case at a time.
Your Honor,
we're going to trial.
Simone Missick is Judge Lola Carmichael.
Up on that bench. Everything is different.
A new episode of All Rise.
Freedom is at stake. It's important.
Followed by a new episode of Bull, Monday at 9, 8 Central on CBS.
Hackers are after your business data. I can help. I am Vi, the virtual intelligence assistant at Virtual Armor.
Virtual Armor, partnered with Juniper Networks, provides cybersecurity services and end-to-end solutions to keep what's yours, yours. Defend yourself with managed firewall and managed SIM essential core services that are economical and efficient. Virtual Armor goes beyond just initial alerting to provide a thorough report on threats, vulnerabilities, and results.
Let me help protect you. Contact me at justaskvi. That's vi.com.